Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Thanks for being with us on the show today. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. In studio with me is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. We're glad to have you along for the program, which, by the way, we should point out has been pre-recorded for this week, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls this time around. However, you can always send us questions for any of our four mayors. You can email those to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. All right, so you're taking the week of July 4th off.
Yes, I am.
We're on tape as people hear this. What are you doing when you're not on this show? Are you doing work or are you just slacking?
No, I'm planning for the next time we have the wonderful opportunity to have these wonderful conversations. And the good thing about this being pre-recorded is that we can enhance my voice and we can actually change the answers, correct?
Well, sure. You can always change your answers, but we reserve the right to keep the tape and ask you about them later.
Yeah.
So let me start with some listener questions that have come in since your last visit. Actually, during the middle of our last show, right at the end of it, there was a question that came in that I didn't have a chance to get to you, which is from Shelley, who asks, will it ever be possible to have overhead turn lane signage on both north and southbound Salisbury Street at the intersections with Fowler and Wiggins?
Sure, we can look at that. A lot of times, there, believe it or not, there is somewhat of a science about signage, electronic signals, those sort of things at intersections. And usually what it has to do with is the volume of traffic, the predominant direction of the traffic flow, how much either of a impediment it's going to be or how it's going to help move traffic along. Believe there is oftentimes this level of awareness on the part of traffic engineers. They realize that traffic generally does dictate its own favorite route to go. And whatever regulatory devices we use always has to be done with the understanding that if it's for the greater good, if it's going to help improve traffic flow, we'll be right on it. If not, then we might want to go ahead and allow for traffic to do what it naturally does. With what we're doing right now with the State Street project and everything that's going on along with that State Street project, basically, we're going to have to revisit the traffic controls, whether they be posted or whether they be electronic, at every intersection, because we have a general understanding about how well things are going to work. But until we actually get folks out there experimenting and trying to figure out new ways to get from point A to point B, we don't know how that's going to work. So short answer is yes, we can often do that based upon the data of the intersection. But will that happen immediately? For instance, after the end of this interview, probably not. We'll go ahead and do some research, and then we'll go ahead and see what the actual traffic flow is going to be like once we get our construction projects done.
While we're on the subject of traffic signs and signals, I see that the city has come to some sort of an agreement with a company that can help you get all of your signals on the same system and put in some sort of an order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of communities are going to an electronic looping system, or basically a wireless system, to go ahead and get your signals synchronized and be able to do that on the fly. As an example, we have a rather antiquated system that we use with that when it comes to emergency vehicles. For instance, our fire station two, which is located at Navajo and Salisbury, they basically have a system where once the fire trucks leave the station house, they can have the light signal automatically change at Navajo and Salisbury. And if they're heading north on Salisbury, crossing 52, they can go ahead and have that synchronized and change as well as when they're going through. We have a lot of our signals basically interfacing like that. And that's where we're transitioning to for the future. Quite clearly, with the type of traffic that we have in West Lafayette, you have a bunch of cars going in the same direction at 8 o'clock, a bunch of cars going in the exact opposite same direction at around 5 o'clock. It creates a lot of constriction, specifically in the area near Navajo and 52. We are looking at ways to try and get that better synchronized. And the best way to do it is to be able to be able to react to that immediately. So that requires a camera system so that you can see what the traffic is doing and then having some way of remotely adjusting the signal so that it could be more efficient. We're in the process of looking at that, but obviously that requires a bit of research. Again, back to the same answer as the other question, making sure the traffic flow is going to be suitable for that, and then getting the money to go ahead and do the installation.
Does that mean you're going to have a person who monitors that, or is it going to be something like sensors in the road dictate, I see there's a lot more traffic now, and thus we should take plan B or plan C for these people?
Yes. It'll be either or. Depending upon what type of system you can get, it can be done remotely. It can be done through dispatch, where the police department gets their calls in and out, or we could actually do it through the engineer's office. But a lot of times what you do is you realize when there's some consistency with a route being constricted or consistency when, you know, the routes are being elongated and people are having a more efficient way of getting through the intersections, you can go ahead and adjust the signals based upon that particular time. You do traffic counts, and we can do automatic traffic counts, and we know the volume of vehicles that go through there, and then we can make the appropriate adjustments so they can be manually adjusted, but they can be adjusted in such a way that they will routinely respond to that direction and make it easier for the folks to get through.
I was going to say, it would seem like you could start with some assumptions of, we know that these intersections are going to be the high traffic mm-hmm. problem areas, but you would have to probably generate a fair amount more data to determine, A, if you're right about those assumptions, and B, if there are places you don't know that are problems.
Correct. And believe it or not, people are pretty smart about trying to get home at night. And oftentimes if they look down the road and they see there's a bunch of red lights, a bunch of brake lights being lit up, that they will more than likely go through a different route to get there. And where we run into the problems is when people choose to go through neighborhoods. For instance, if they're used to going up, say, Northwestern, are used to going up McCormick, and they can go at a specific rate of speed, and they can get home in a certain amount of time, and that all of a sudden becomes congested, whether it be through a traffic project or just an increase in volume, people will make new routes. And sometimes when those routes go through neighborhoods, that's when we get a lot of complaints. And when it's consistent enough over a period of time, that's when you'll see some things like speed bumps and speed humps and those sort of things growing up in cities.
So what is this going to cost the city, and how long is implementation likely to take?
That is a fabulous question. I have no idea how much that's going to cost because we're still doing the legwork and the research. Traditionally, those things aren't really as expensive as you would think. It's really not that sophisticated of a system. The difficulty comes in and when you have to dig up the roadway to put the loops there. Some of the sensing devices can be somewhat high maintenance because of the weather extremes that they have to go through, and then making sure they have the right RF to go ahead and link into our system at the radio center. That's where the expense comes in. But the whole point of it is making sure you do it right. You know, a lot of cities have what they call smart grids. And those smart grids basically have all kinds of different monitoring devices to where you can change it on the fly. And it's based on a wireless system. It's based on camera systems. It's based on different kinds of networking that really does work well in large cities. In a city our size, with the concentrations of traffic that we have, and this would be on both sides of the river, it would be a really good opportunity to test that type of equipment and to see how well it would work in a smaller city.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're chatting today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. This week's program has been pre-recorded, but you can always send questions for any of our mayors to ask@WBAA.org. You can also tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Here's another question that's come in. Mike has written in, and he says, I have a good friend who's quadriplegic and therefore in a full-size wheelchair. He lives downtown and enjoys visiting the shops, but a sizable portion of the businesses aren't handicap accessible due to the front steps of the buildings or the width of the door. Does the new State Street project improve this situation for all of these storefronts?
That was one of the priorities with the project, to make sure that it's accessible. Generally speaking, businesses have been sort of under the gun to get that taken care of for quite some time. I'm sort of surprised that that would be a challenge for them still. And we've got a really strong advocate in our community. Her name's Jan Myers, and she goes by the moniker of Roundfoot. And she is on a motorized wheelchair. She attends most of our council meetings, and she's always ready to provide guidance to us, whether it's welcome or not, about how we can improve accessibility within the city of West Lafayette. Businesses themselves, again, they have been under direction for quite some time now to meet ADA standards. I can't imagine up and down.
Well, we should say that there are a fair number of grandfathering clauses within the ADA that if a structure was built before a certain time, mm-hmm. it's grandfathered in. I know that, for instance, residential structures, mm-hmm. If you've got steps in front of your house, for instance, mm-hmm. that come up from the sidewalk, there are rules that say you do or don't have to put in railings, things mm-hmm. like that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a fair amount of grandfathering sure. that goes on with the ADA.
Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I mean, with what we've been told, I mean, a lot of the projects that we've done prior to us getting in office had to be redone because they weren't accessible. Years ago, Jan and I, she let me use one of her old wheelchairs, and she was in her new souped-up wheelchair, and we drove around the city and trying to figure out how difficult it is for folks with limited ability to get even up and down our sidewalks, you know, things that we would never consider. For instance, the way the sidewalks integrate with the driveway. Sometimes they have these unreasonable humps when the two surfaces actually meet, and it can throw you right out of your wheelchair. So we've gone through a relatively methodical process to try and make sure that we are ahead of the game when it comes to being ADA compliant. The challenges that we have is when you're dealing with private business owners or private property owners. We have rules and regulations that we can enforce, and then because of such things as being able to grandfather things in, or because of such things as having maybe not necessarily at the front door, but having an accessible point at the rear or an accessible point through another business, something to that effect. It can be somewhat of a slippery slope. So I guess, boy, not to get off topic here, but the fact of the matter is that in the event that somebody feels that there is something that's not in compliance, they need to notify us, let us know. Then through our ADA and accessibility committee, we can go ahead and make sure that things get squared away.
On to another topic. We've heard that the Lafayette Police Department, now that the new police body camera law has gone into effect, where you can now, the burden of proof is on the police not to release video and the public should have access to it. Mm-hmm. There's a stipulation in that law that says police departments can charge as much as $150 for copies of that video. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the West Lafayette Police Department has thought about what, if anything, it is going to decide to charge for copies of this video that are requested by the public.
Funny, we were just talking about that yesterday, the chief and I, Chief Jason Dembkowski, and I were having a conversation. We have not yet. The law has just recently changed, and this thing is still evolving because the idea of a body camera is still relatively new. There's a few factors that enter into play here. First off is the cost of storage. You know, basically, even though it's a visual image, it's data. And it's a huge file, generally speaking. When you talk about recording something of substance, it takes up a lot of space on a server, so that requires more money for servers, more money for storage, than a place to put the storage, et cetera, et cetera.
This is going to seem like a totally pedantic question, but I want to ask it straight away anyhow. Your body cameras, mm-hmm. are they recording in HD or not?
That is a great question.
It's going to make a difference.
I think so. I think so. And the only reason why is because the quality of imagery that when it's transferred is still relatively high. The resolution is relatively high. And I remember back in the old days when I was a police officer, we started having that first iteration of car cameras. And man, the resolution in that stuff was horrible. You literally had to have a narrative attached to it so you could identify certain things. And it's much better quality than that. So I'd have to think that, yes, it is digital.
Because that's, of course, going to take a lot more space, and thus you're
yes.
going to have to pay for more and more terabytes
yes.
of storage.
Oh, yes. And there are laws that are going to govern how long that has to be held. Right now, some of the concerns that some of the mayors and administrators have about the body cams is, first off, the cost of storage. Second off, there was a concern about something that they called the nosy neighbor rule. And this is something that probably is just a trickle down of people wanting to see what's going on when they don't have a right to. There was a law that's going to be, I think, in effect today that's going to put a little bit tighter lid on what can be viewed and who can view it. I think as it stands right now, if you are pictured in the video, then you have a right to view. You have viewing rights. And again, the viewing rights are actually going to be set up by whatever agency, when, where, how, and under what kind of conditions. That one of the first concerns that a police officer made me aware of would be, okay, hypothetically, let's say that there's some event going on and Stan Jastrzewski is watching this event, and all of a sudden Stan thinks this might be of value. So Stan runs in there and sort of photobombs the event as it's going on. In theory, you are included in that event, and yet you're fully trained, highly skilled, wonderfully eloquent professional news guy. So does that then mean that because of that, you are entitled to view that video?
No, but it means I'm entitled to view it if I think it's newsworthy.
Well, that's a different avenue. Okay, we're talking about just the absolute of because I'm in it, I get to see it. But as a reporter, you've obviously got a different avenue to go through that always has been there, and it's always going to be sanctioned, and it's always going to happen. And I know in our police department here in West Lafayette, we're going to make sure that we accommodate whatever need we can do.
Well, we should say that the bill started out completely the opposite way.
Oh, yeah.
It started out where the burden of proof was going to be on the press
yes.
and not on the police.
Well, there was a heck of a lot of lobbying that went on
yes.
down at the State House, and I believe the Senate opened it up even further.
Yes,
they,
yes.
They made it even more accessible.
Yes, the bill became much more wider in scope of what mm-hmm. was allowed.
Yeah. And the one thing, and again, I've been out of police work now for almost a decade, and there are two things that police officers always consider, and I guess maybe police administrators and prosecutors. First off, they never want to get themselves in a situation to where they're going to be overtly, obviously wrong. They don't want a Rodney King situation to be immediately blasted around the world. And the second thing is they don't want to taint a case from the prosecutorial side. They don't want to taint the case. There's this evidentiary threshold that they need to be cautious about. So how do you – and those are the extremes, obviously. So how do you condense that into where it's going to provide what we as public servants take an oath to do, which is to serve our communities? How do you – what is that threshold? And I'm sure any police administrator or any mayor that you ask, it's going to change. You know, my opinion, if it should be viewable, then it should be viewable.
Let me ask you something about the average, say, traffic stop that might get recorded on a body cam, because the cop will pull someone over, flip the camera on, walk up, start talking to the person in the driver's seat. In your experience as a police officer, how long is the average interaction with somebody, be it a traffic stop or otherwise, that you might be recording? Is it normally that you're done in, say, fewer than 10 minutes, or are there a significant portion that take a little while to adjudicate?
It depends on what the weather's like.
Fair point.
If it's raining or cold, yeah, a lot less than – no. It depends. I mean, there's so many different circumstances that happen. Oftentimes, you go ahead and when you initialize the traffic stop, you're doing some stuff with radio, you're doing some stuff with your car to put yourself in a position to pull the car over, and you're setting your car up in a position so nobody gets hurt. And from that point on, as soon as you exit the car – as I understand it, the body cams go on. Again, in the old days when they had car cams, as soon as you hit the lights, the car cam would go on. So it's immediately recording as soon as – before you even get out of the car. And then it stays on until that system is sort of reinitiated. You break the curtilage of the car, you go back into the car, or the police officer shuts it off manually. And the same thing when you cut the lights down, then it goes off. So there are systems that are beyond the manual control of the officer to shut off. And the other side of that is if an officer manually shuts off his body cam, then it's noted.
Well, what I'm getting at is how long are the individual files going to be that are going back into the central storage?
Yeah, it's going to be big because the average traffic stop takes maybe 10 minutes. I mean, you walk up, you do some stuff, you say some stuff, you get some information, you go back, you do some work with the information, you walk back up and do whatever you're going to do, give them the ticket or make a recommendation or
– And so what all this gets back to is the idea of does it in fact cost $150 to make somebody a copy of one of these, which is what the law is talking about. And the law essentially says that police departments can't make a profit on this. They say that you can charge the lesser of whatever it costs you to make the copy or $150. And it was interesting to me that the Lafayette police were going straight to the state maximum of $150. And so I'm trying to figure out, does it in fact cost $150, especially if it's a one-time fee for buying all of the data, one-time fee for buying all of the cameras themselves and all the storage technology? It would seem hard to justify $150 for every single copy, especially in this digital age in which we live, where you could make it available digitally on a secure website where you don't even have to pay for the storage medium.
It could be online. You're exactly right. But I do know that when you talk about law enforcement stuff, when you talk about government stuff, when you talk about stuff that has repercussions far beyond just the original viewage of that, it gets pretty testy. I mean, you know,
well, one of the arguments I've heard made is
that law enforcement is somewhat under a microscope anyway. There's been a lot of big, nasty mistakes made by police officers over the past decade or so.
Well, right, but that doesn't give them a right to charge more for these
absolutely
videos.
Absolutely not, but it does heighten their sensitivity to what's going to happen with this, if this what. And I understand that that is probably one of the drivers. You're going to have, you know, a case can get tainted, and it could be a major crime. It could get tainted with the most innocent of activity. And the way things work now, they don't go through a trial unless they have a high degree of certainty that it's going to go their way. They're not going to take on a bad case. And if the evidence, regardless whether it be video evidence or actually some sort of physical evidence, gets tainted, then it's back to the drawing board, and there was a huge expense with that. So I think that 150 thing, I don't know how they came up with that number. And again, like I said, I've been out of this thing for a long time. I know that when we used to have hard copies requested for police reports, it was a flat fee. It was $10 a page or something to that effect. And now,
and I believe there's a state statute that specifies a maximum for that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, up to a certain amount of pages, and then it goes to another. Yeah. And maybe that's what they'll end up doing with data. you know, because the physical, the video imagery is one thing. But what about when you're starting to get into phone things, when you're starting to get data that basically requires you to crack open somebody's phone and get the information off of that? And there,
well,
there
we should
video.
Say that the bill only is for Belief
right,
body camera
right, but I'm just saying right now that because of what we're doing with technology now, you know, who knows where things are going to go. They have these things in smart grids and smart cities. They have these things now where there are cameras everywhere. There's cameras that monitor gas stations, monitor convenience stores, monitor intersections, monitor stretches of road with the intent of – it's not necessarily a public safety thing, but it's more of a traffic flow thing, you know, more of something that's basically a city service. But because it's recording live, then you have that other option of having CCTV all throughout your city. And it can go even deeper than that. You know, depending upon where we go as a society, you might even be able to get data based upon somebody carrying a chip that's in their driver's license, like the little chips on your credit cards. You could have that chip in your driver's license. You get involved in an accident, and before the paramedics get there, they know your biometrics. They know what's going on with you as a human being. They know if you have any diseases, if you have any contagious, any of that kind of stuff. We're gravitating towards that. And the bigger question to me is that, you know, in the infamous words of one of my favorite 70s songs, "Hey, Big Brother," or is this a smarter way to provide high quality services and medical care to a society? I don't know. You know, I know that if they ever have my business on a chip, they're probably going to get pretty surprised.
On to another topic.
Good idea.
Your city, like Lafayette, is conducting a tree inventory mm-hmm. right now. What are you hoping to learn from that?
Well, we have always been kind of noted around the state as a tree city. We're one of the many tree cities in the state of Indiana. And what we do is there are several different things that apply to trees. Obviously, size, age, you know, the root system. Is it interrupting anything? How many trees you have? How many trees you need? What kind of condition they're in so far, if you have trees that are large, if they're dying from the inside out. And then the trees that you have that have the infectious diseases. We currently are under a huge issue with our ash trees. The ash borer has pretty much taken them out. Ash trees are pretty big, so we're going to go ahead and take those out. I think we have 900 total ash trees, and we're in the process of getting most of those out. So it's basically kind of like your city physical when it comes to your green space and your trees.
And so I wondered about the ash borer, because one of the things that I think that happened with that is that the state became very reactive. There were mm-hmm. lots and lots of communities that all of a sudden had the emerald ash borer, mm-hmm. and your city is no different than Bloomington or mm-hmm. Lafayette or lots of other places that mm-hmm. have had to cut down scores and scores of ash trees. Mm-hmm. Does this inventory help you to get out in front of whatever is the next ash borer that starts threatening some other tree population?
Which there will be.
Yes.
I mean, we know that for sure. In a way, it does. It allows for us, insofar as budget goes, to kind of know how much it's going to cost to get them removed. With the ash tree, because they're so big, it's about $1,000 a tree. And when you figure about 900 trees, well, you know, that is in my mind, when I add it all up, it's a lot of money. But other trees aren't going to grow that way. Other trees, when we know that this invasive insect is coming, we can take some proactive measures to treat. But from what my tree folks tell me, there's a certain period in the lifespan of a tree where you can't help it out. If there's going to be an invasive species come, you can treat it all you want, but they're still going to get in and eat it up and kill it. So the inventory does. It helps us know what we have, what type of what we have, how to identify it, in other words. And then in the event that there is some sort of invasive species, it allows for us to start the process of budgeting to get those removed.
A couple other things before we have to go today. Mitch Daniels, a few weeks ago, started talking, and he said, mentioned it a couple of times since, about the possibility of building a conference center on the west end of mm-hmm. campus for use by the university, by the city. And one of the things he says is, there is unmet demand for this sort of space in West Lafayette or at Purdue. Do you believe that to be true?
Absolutely. We have one facility that is just so overused. It's on the north end of the city near Walmart. And it is so difficult to get space to book there. And at Purdue, we have huge events. And we've got the Union. And then we've got this place at the north. But we have big events. We as a city have big events. People come in, vendors come in, and they need some type of convention space for, you know, doing exactly what they're built for. And it's not just some great big place that you can put a roof over and have a bunch of tables in there, but there has to have food services. It's got to have climate control. It's got to have the possibility of rooms. It's got to have the possibility of entertainment. And when you have an international university and when you have a community that's a draw like Greater Lafayette is, the spaces that we have are pretty much undersized and in some case under-facilitated for that particular need. So absolutely, yeah.
Have you been asked as a city to help pony up any money to get something like that built?
Not yet.
Do you expect to be?
No, not necessarily. It'll probably be a Purdue investment.
And so that brings us to the next part, which is where that conference center would theoretically be located is going to be either within or almost immediately adjacent to one of the TIF districts mm-hmm. that is hopefully going to provide money for the State Street project over the course of the next 30 years or mm-hmm. something. Have you begun to look at how much those TIF districts are already capable of making? Because it seemed we talked on last mm-hmm. month's program about the fact that the city's basically stretched as far as it can with respect to taxing authority at this mm-hmm. point. And so you really need these TIF districts to make you money so you can pay $60 million plus dollars back to Purdue over the next 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. What does your modeling show in terms of what those are producing and are capable of producing?
Well, in all honesty, we now have a master developer for the Western Innovation District. And they're responsible for dealing with that. We know that insofar as a developable area, it pretty much has the trifecta for success. You've got a highway, you've got a rail spur, and you've got an airport. And generally speaking, when you have those three components, it's rock star stuff. So we're not at all worried about if. We're focused on what. And that's one of the neat things about being with a world-class university and having a city that has such a high quality of life. We want to make sure that what goes in there fits. And that's where we're having all this dialogue with Purdue, and that's where we're having some reach out with our citizenry because they want to know what's going to go there. They're concerned about the Hort Park. They're concerned about the green space. And in everybody that we've met with, we made them aware of the fact that that's a priority. Browning, who's the master developer for that area, acutely understands that. And so my presumption is that with that recognition, that understanding of what we want there, that it's going to go, and that's going to go at a high rate. Again, given where it is, it is in a pretty popular area for development. So we really haven't done a parcel-by-parcel assessment because, again, that could be contingent upon who's going to build something there and what that something's going to be.
Is the city part of the discussions about who those eventual tenants might be, or is that strictly a Purdue thing?
It's us. It's the city and Purdue. We have monthly meetings about what's going on out there. And some of it's a real paradigm shift. Some of it, you know, we are so acclimated to thinking of Purdue as an academic institution where only research facilities and or offshoots from that research facility go. We're changing our minds now. We're looking at how do we best suit this community? How do we best suit the western end of Greater Lafayette? And we're looking at more interesting retail opportunities. And we're looking at things that aren't just going to provide entertainment and recreational opportunities for our students, but also for the community as a whole.
Mitch Daniels says we may not have cars there in 20 years or something
like that. Mitch Daniels, I bet you he wouldn't say that about motorcycles.
That's probably true. All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks so much. That's all the time we've got. We appreciate your time as always. Enjoy your July 4th.
You too, Stan.
And we'll talk to you again next month.
You know it.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can find all of these programs archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. And you can always send questions for any of our mayors to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.